We'll just have a short reading from there as we begin our study. John chapter 1. It's a passage taken from our daily Bible reading from this past week. John chapter 1, starting verse 35 with me. The next day, again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by, and he said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." And two of the disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus, and Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," that is, teacher, "where are you staying?" And he said to them, "Come and you will see." So they came, and they saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was named Andrew. He was Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother, Simon, and he said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which means Christ. And he brought him to Jesus, and Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You will be called Cephas," which means Peter. We can stop just right there. This was just the first part of the reading that came from our Bible reading plan this past week. And it was one that just that I read, and as sometimes it happens, it begins to make you think about other things, and you begin to think maybe about something, as we talked about in our class this morning with our young people, with JJ teaching some things that sometimes you read that you just don't necessarily think about or doesn't strike you in the way that it has before. And for whatever reason, this was one of those times where it caused me to think about, on a very personal level, all of the people who made up this group of what we might call these first disciples of Jesus. All of these people, particularly, we get a little insight here in the other passages that were taught about Jesus calling his disciples in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke. This one gives a little bit more of an intimate picture of Simon and of Andrew coming to the Lord. But I started to think about, for whatever reason, these first disciples. Not only here, but the ones that would become disciples when the gospel began to be taught through the ministry of Jesus, as well as into the book of Acts. And what things, I started to think, what things were true about these people that might give me something to reflect on? What's true about these individuals? What is true about these people that should cause me to think about my discipleship of the Lord in relation to what these people were and what they did and how they thought and how they acted? And I thought, why not just read all of these little accounts of Jesus calling his disciples and think about those early narratives of those people? And it gave me something to think about, and I'm just going to share them with you tonight. And maybe they can give you something, some point of meditation for your week about your own discipleship and your own commitment to the Lord. And we could do, "Who Are These People?" is the title that we've put up here. We could do a big picture sort of study. We could step back and say, what does it mean to be a disciple? And we could get our word study books out, and we could look up the words, and we could find out what. Why would Paul or why would Jesus use these words? Or we could step back and we could look at ask these big questions about the doctrines that Jesus would teach, about what it means to follow him and what it means to be a disciple, all of these kind of things, which all would be beneficial and wonderful. But I don't want to do that tonight. What I'd rather do is lower ourselves down maybe to the people level. And any time for me, and I do this maybe too often, I don't know, I any time I can stop and read these narratives and read the stories from the Old Testament or the New Testament and find common ground and be encouraged on the fact that what we're reading are not fairy tales, and what we're reading are not just somebody writing good stories, but what we're reading are accounts of people with whom I share a connection because I is one, right? I'm just like them, and you are just like them. We are people, and these people are motivated by the love of this one who is called the Messiah, and this beautiful little narrative here of Andrew being called by John, and they behold the Lamb of God, and Andrew becomes one who is touched by this one, and he is convinced and he's motivated by this one that he says, we have found the Messiah. And he immediately goes and he tells his brother, what are the things that maybe we have in common with these people? Who are these people, and what can I learn from their discipleship on a people level? And hopefully as we get through, I'll give you a few of these things, maybe it'll challenge you to think, and maybe you understand where we're coming from. So what we need to do, and we won't read them all because you've all read them and are familiar with them likely, the account of Jesus calling and naming all of these first 12 people is found in all three of the first Gospels, and then including this one in a little more intimate way. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all record, all very similar, with only minor wordings and a name recorded differently here and there. And what we're going to do is look at a few of the narratives from the book of Acts as well, not just those first 12, but then the first that come after Jesus goes back to heaven, and thinking about some of those things. Let me give you just four or five things to think about here. Number one, and these may seem basic, but I hope that will give us something to think about. Number one, I think it's really important to understand that these folks whom Jesus calls initially and then would later be called in the book of Acts, they're just ordinary people. They are just ordinary. They are the yous and me's of life. They are the ones. They don't have any wealth. They're not men of great renown. They're not men of great education. They are not theological scholars. They're not particularly influential in their communities or in their groups of people. They don't really have any social standing. They are the common people. They are the workers. They are the common folks of the day. All of them were from the region of Galilee. All of them, or at least many of them, from a small village called Bethsaida that we read about. Some of them were from Capernaum, or others were possibly from Cana or from Nazareth. But all of them were from this small, insignificant region surrounding the Sea of Galilee. And they are just, as we've said, ordinary things. There was this great little book, it's not that little, but this great book written back in the 70s called Evangelism in the Early Church. And it's a book about the same kind of idea, this people-level stuff. What are the things that these people did? And the opening paragraph describes these men by saying it was a small group of 11 men whom Jesus commissioned to carry on his work and bring the gospel to the whole world. They were not distinguished. They were not well-educated. They had no influential backers or supporters. In their own nation, they were nobodies, and in any case, their own nation was a mere second-class province on the eastern extremity of the Roman map. In other words, way over there where we don't typically like to go. Right? They are on the far eastern shore of this thing. If they had stopped, he writes, to weigh up the probabilities of succeeding in their mission, even granted their conviction that Jesus was alive and that his spirit went with them to equip them for their task, their hearts must surely have sunk, so heavily were the odds weighted against them. How could they possibly succeed? And yet they did. And yet they did. And it's true to think about these people. They are just ordinary folks. It's not to say that Christian people are, or that they're not people who are Christians who are extraordinary folks. It's not to mean that we all have to be uneducated, you know, low on the social standing. That's not what we're meaning at all, but it's something that challenges us to say that we have some, that these men in some ways can be raised on a pedestal as being the first of the disciples and to be challenged by this, but in many ways can be lowered back down and say they're just like you and me. They are people for whom the Lord found great commitment. Someone said once, and I remember back when I was in school, told me that Jesus, in seeking for disciples, is looking not so much for extraordinary people, but ordinary people who can do ordinary things extraordinarily well. He looks for us to be individuals in our lives. I think it's important when you think of at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Do you remember that? It's just really simple, just a really straightforward statement, and is easily read over. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, when he's given these unbelievably great truths about the Christian life, at the end we're just simply told, and the common people heard him gladly. The message of Jesus was appealing to the people who were just the everyday folks. And so these disciples, right at the beginning, we find that we have a lot in common with them. And the reason why it's important for us, and the reason why I think it's challenging for us, is that the important thing is not what, in becoming a disciple, is not about what we are, but is about what we can become. Because we are ordinary people, and can be ordinary people for the rest of our lives, but ordinary people washed in the blood of Jesus, changed and transformed into something that is great, is the beauty of what the work of the Lord can do. Bill called attention to it this morning when we read the early part of Ephesians chapter 5, right? The quotation that we had up here, that you used to be in darkness, right? This was the point that Paul makes. You used to be in darkness, but now you are changed by your very nature. You are light. Christ has shined upon you. You are different than you used to be. Your nature used to be to live this way, but now you are washed. You are changed. You are transformed. You are light. Remembers Paul's affirmation back in the book of 2 Corinthians in chapter 3 when he talks about Moses coming down off the mountain, and our young people have talked about it a lot. When he comes down off the mountain and he opens, and the people can look at his face, and they can't because he's veiled. And he said, no, now we are people who get to stand and behold the glory of the Lord. And by doing that, he said, we are being transformed into his image. By being the people who stand and gaze upon the beauty of God, ordinary or extraordinary. It's not about who we are, it's about who we can become. The Lord is a master at taking ordinary things or ordinary people and making great things out of them and doing wonderful things that the world can't comprehend out of the smallest of our efforts. And we're just like everyone else. The beautiful hymn is so true, and my favorite verse in it is the last one, just as I am, right? Your love unknown has broken every barrier down. Think about how profound it is to say, I can come to you in whatever shape that I am, just who I am, and the love that you have shown to me breaks every barrier down and takes away every barrier to me to accomplish great things, because I am yours. And that's the last part of the verse. Now to be thine and thine alone, Lamb of God, I come. It's the image. They're just ordinary people. But I think also to think about these individuals, not only that they are just ordinary people, they were extraordinarily diverse group of people. They were just like you and me, in that not any of us is the same. And that all of us have different ways of doing things, different ways of thinking, and different ways of going about our business and raising our families, and all of the, you know, and those are just the surface level things that make us different. Some of them were brothers, some of them maybe were friends, some of them worked together in the fishing business maybe, some of them, they typified what the early church would be. Matthew and Simon are, of course, the two that are the most obvious differences. And the most obvious example of what it means to be a group of people who are diverse, if we know the occupations of the two men, right? Matthew was a tax collector, right? And Simon the Zealot was, right? We don't know his occupation, but part of his ideology was he was a zealot, right? Those are two ways of viewing the world which could not be more opposite during this time. They are two men who are called by Jesus. Matthew, of course, is the tax collector. He's the employee of the government. He's hated by most people. He is one who is looked upon most often, if you were a Jew of everyday society, the people who were Jewish men who were workers for the Roman government often were looked upon as sellouts. They were the one who took the buyout and went to work for the people that we don't like for the money, and they're going to exploit the opportunity they have to get more money. And it was just, whether it was true about every individual, we don't know, but it was the common perception of what it was. He was the government worker. He was employed by them, and it was the opposite of a patriot or a lover of his country. Simon, sometime one, I think Luke calls him the Canaanite, and the other versions calls him the Zealot. He's part of that group of people whose first and foremost passion is the nation of the Hebrew people. He's a nationalist. He's one, Josephus said about these people that they were inviolably attached to liberty and gave obedience to only one Lord, the God of heaven, and made their efforts to be antagonistic to everything that had to do with the Roman government. They were had nothing to do with them, nothing to do with anyone or anything had to do with the government of Rome. They were often given over to violence. There are accounts in early first century life in which the zealots were gladly taking the lives of Roman soldiers or Roman people simply because they were going to be loyal to their country, overly so. Whether Simon was like that or not, we don't know. But we do know that these two people were called to be part of a small group of people to follow the Lord, both of whom put their faith in Him, both of whom saw Jesus as a motivator, and both of whom saw Jesus as Messiah and Lord, and said, we are going to follow Him. And we don't really know anything more about what Jesus asked them to do or not do concerning the way that they viewed the world or their ideology or whatever you might want to call it. The plain fact of the matter is this. These two people were disciples of the Lord, and maybe that was all that they had in common. That might have been it. Period. And yet they were disciples of the Lord, and we don't know anything more beyond that. Unity in Jesus, and it is a, there are many, many places that Paul and Peter and the apostles who write in the New Testament and Jesus who rails against people who cause division and who cause problems among groups. Unity in Christ does not ask us to be all the same people. To be a group of people who serve the Lord allows us to have a common faith and allows us to put trust in a Lord who has volunteered to save me in spite of myself and has done the same for you, and does not ask us to all be the same people. It asks us to follow His will, and it asks us to be His disciple and to be His follower and to be the kind of people who trust Him and love Him and also do the same for each other. Unity in Christ does not mean we all have to be cookie-cutter people, because we all have our differences. Matthew and Simon are maybe these two great examples. Maybe, and dare I say it, might it be possible for Christians to view public life differently than other Christians and yet still be devoted disciples and Christians? It would seem to me that Matthew and Simon would be the most glaring example of the case. Yes. And we can love and share with one another, and we can love and serve the Lord with one another, despite how we might view the world and how we might view our place in public life. Simon and Matthew are good examples. There are places, for example, remember in later in this same passage in the book of John, when Jesus comes, after we read about Simon and Andrew, and he encounters two other people. Do you remember Philip and Nathaniel? Do you remember Nathaniel's statement about the people of Nazareth? He really loved them and had a lot in common with those and had great respect for the people of Nazareth, right? Of course not. Do you remember the saying? If you read, when Jesus, they find out Jesus is from Nazareth, and Philip's and Nathaniel says, what? What good comes out of that place? You think he might have had a little bit of antagonism toward people who are from Nazareth? Now, I would hope that in becoming a disciple, maybe he thought of them a little higher, because Jesus was one who came from Nazareth. And I would hope that maybe he would view people a little differently. But it doesn't take away from the fact that something in the life of Nathanael had caused him to think less of the people of Nazareth, which means they probably had some differences. And that's okay. We are disciples of the Lord who are all ordinary people, but are extraordinarily diverse. All right, let's think of a couple other things. So, again, this might seem really obvious, but it's good to think about it. These ordinary people, and this diverse group of people, they did ordinary people things. They did things that just everyone else had to do. They did really simple, ordinary people things. That includes the good things that you and I have to do every day, like have jobs and work and build relationships and build families. And it also includes unfortunate things, like making mistakes and doing things that maybe we ought not do. All of these people, including these 12 who Jesus called and then appointed as apostles, were people who did ordinary people things. If you go on from there and you think about the Apostle Paul, maybe the most extraordinary man, I guess if you want to say that, he was the one who carried the gospel to countless numbers of people all over the Roman world. We can raise him up on a pedestal as being unbelievably extraordinary in many, many ways. But it's also important that we remember that Paul, ordinary man, did ordinary people things, just like you and me. When we read the book of Acts, it's difficult because there's 28 chapters and we read it one chapter after the other, and it reads sort of like this beautiful continuous story that sort of starts here and it just flows along, and then a short period of time is covered, and then we get to the end and Paul's at the end of his life. We forget that from, you know, chapter 2 to chapter 28 is about 30 some years maybe of time that it covers. So when we read the story, particularly of the life of Paul, we read the story, and if you just read it from chapter to chapter to chapter, it sort of sounds like Paul is just running to one city and doing a little bit and then pack it up and running to another city and doing a little bit, and then he goes and preaches to this city, and it just seems like he's just nonstop going from one to the other. And we forget that there were times in the ministry of Paul that he lived in places and actually had to stop. And you remember he had a job, right? He had to support himself, and so he was a tent maker. And so he would live and work and get up every day and go to work and get those things done, come home, and he would live in a place, some places, if we're told, in Ephesus, he lived for 3 years, correct? Maybe another place is longer, maybe another place is shorter, but he did ordinary people things, like get up and go to work every day, but was a disciple of the Lord, being the extraordinary person that Paul was, all the while doing everyday things, a person just like you and like me. We also include not only the things that are the, you know, just typical good things, but we might think about the sort of negative things. You remember if you go back to later on in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 7, after the many, many people are converted from 3,000 to 5,000, and we've got all of the church trying to find their place and how to understand what's going on. There's a group of people, they are the Greek-speaking women, the Greek-speaking widows. And in the story we find out, and we studied this earlier on in the year, the Greek-speaking widows are missing out on the daily distribution of food. They've been taking care of them. Been taking care of everybody. Food was being distributed to try to make sure everybody's fed. And there's this group of widows, for whatever reason, they get left out. They don't get the food that they need. And we can ask the questions, and we did in our class, why do you think that was? Well, maybe it was an honest mistake. Maybe they just didn't think about it. Maybe they were prejudiced because they were Greek-speaking people and they didn't deserve it as much. And so maybe it was deliberate. Whatever the reason, it doesn't really matter. There was a group of ladies who were being left out, which turned out to be a mistake. And so what the people have to do is fix it. This large group of people who are this beautiful force for good in the city of Jerusalem, all becoming Christians and making massive impact by 3,000 and 5,000 people and teaching and loving and serving and worshiping and all of these wonderful things, right in the middle of their doing great work, they make this mistake of leaving these poor widows out. Guess why? Because they're people, just like you and me. And they do ordinary people things, like have jobs and work every day and raise families, and also mess up sometimes. Peter's the example of that, right? Paul is an example of that. Peter, later on in our reading, in the life of the Apostle Paul, he's the one who becomes sort of chummy with the Jewish people and begins to push aside, if you read about in the book of Galatians, pushes aside the Gentile people, and Paul has to confront him and say, this is not right. You can't do this to people all of this happens because Peter is an ordinary person who does ordinary things, just like you and me. And so there are things that have to think, that challenge us to think about these things. Paul and Barnabas is another example. Do you remember when Paul and Barnabas have had this great and successful mission work and traveling around the world doing great amounts of good for the gospel? And then when they get ready to go again, do you remember what happens? They have the most ordinary of things. They have an argument and they disagree on something. Essentially, Barnabas says, I think we ought to take the kid. Paul says, I don't think we ought to take the kid. He left us once, he'll do it again. And Barnabas says, no, I think we ought to take the kid. And they have an argument. It becomes sharp and they finally say, you know what, you go do your thing and I'll do my thing. And they part ways and they do wonderful work for the Lord. They do ordinary things like get in fights with friends and arguments and have disagreements about things that they think are important. Guess what? You and I have great experience in being able to do that because we're ordinary people who do ordinary things. So these are just a few little simple examples of that. These people challenge us to think about it in this way. Think about another one. So Jesus, we're told in all of the accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all of them, we're told that Jesus calls these people to be his disciples. He doesn't force them, coerce them, or threaten them. He says, hey, if you follow me, you can. You'll be blessed if you follow me. And all of them do. He calls all of them to simply come to him by virtue of his invitation to come and be part of this. He doesn't have employees that are bound by contract. He has volunteers who are bound by love. When Jesus went back to heaven, when he ascended in the record in the book of Acts in the first chapter, before he goes back to heaven, he tells his people, when they begin to ask him some questions, and he said, I'm not going to be with you. The Spirit's going to come, and he'll give you power. You'll receive power from on high. And then verse 13, he says, and then you are going to go, and you're going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea and in Samaria and all through the ends of the earth. You know what it means to be a witness is, right? It means you have, if you're called to be a witness in a court of law, and if you're called to come and stand on trial and be a witness to something, that means you've seen something and you have to turn and you have to give a testimony of what you saw happen, right? Or be able to answer questions and say, yes, I saw thus and such. When Jesus tells his people, you're going to be my witnesses, they're all witness to the power of the Lord. They're all witness to what Jesus can do, both in what they've seen and what they've heard, but also in what it's done for them. And essentially, Jesus says, when I'm gone, you can decide if what you've seen and heard and what my power has done for your life is worthy for you to turn and to share that sort of a testimony with the world, to be my witness, to give truth by what it is, what I have done for your life, that what I have said and who I am is true. All of this is done by virtue of whether we're willing to do that or not. Not by force or by coercion, but because of what the Lord has done for me. Is it meaningful enough for me to be a witness to the world and turn and share the same sort of testimony of what he can do for you? Those are things that are asked of the people here when Jesus called them and left them a choice to choose or not to, and the same one that's left for us. Let's think of this last one, really simple. In Mark chapter 3, in the record of Jesus calling these people, really simple. Let's start in verse 14, Mark 3 and verse 14, verse 13, excuse me. He went up on the mountain, and he called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him, and he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, in order that they might be with him, and so that he might send them out to preach. Really simple clause right in the middle of there. These people were chosen, they were called, so that they might be with Jesus, so that they might be with him He called them that they might be with him. This is significant in me, for me. It's significant in that what he has asked us to do and what we share with these people is really important to stop and say, I'm going to stop and I'm going to go spend time with Jesus. Do you remember in the book of Acts, when Peter and John, in Acts chapter 4, when Peter and John are on trial and they have been sort of punished and they have been sort of interrogated and they're trying to find out what's going on, and they, in giving their answers for what had happened, we're told in Acts chapter 4, verse 13, when the people saw the boldness of Peter and John, and they perceived that they were uneducated, common people, they were astonished, and then they recognized that they had been with Jesus. Isn't that kind of a beautiful statement? They realized after listening to them talk and listening to them give their answers and listening to them defend themselves and watching the way they conduct themselves and watching the way they live, the people stop and they realize, number one, these people are not educated and they're not trained. They're not people who are scholars, but what we do know is that they have been with Jesus. And I wonder if people, given the opportunity to examine me as a disciple or as a claimed disciple of the Lord, whether they would be able to look at me and they might see really quickly that I'm uneducated and common, but I wonder if they would stop and say, That fellow spends time with Jesus. That guy knows the Lord because it shows. All of these early disciples, who are these people? They are people who evidently and obviously knew the Lord and spent time with him. In the same little book that I mentioned earlier about evangelism in the early church, one of the things that he makes clear over and over again from both from the book of Acts as well as in to the early church history is that the way that they approached teaching people was never organizational. In other words, there was never a plea to come, leave what you're doing, and be a part of this organization that we call the church. It was always part of a message because it naturally, becoming a disciple of the Lord makes you part of a family of people. But the message always was about what Jesus can do and what he has done. And that he says, in his words, the message was relational, more so than organizational. In other words, these people had been with Jesus, and it changed them completely. And they were going to share that with people. And they were going to communicate that with others. Maybe, of all the things that we've talked about tonight, that to me give me encouragement that I can be just like them and that God can do just the same amount of great and amazing things through my simplicity and through my uneducatedness or through my being a common folk. But it gives me encouragement that what really mattered to them most was that it was really evident that being with Jesus was the thing that changed who they were. Now, specifically, they're talking about Peter and John because Peter and John knew him and walked with him and spent time with him. But you and I have the same opportunity and privilege today to stand in the presence of the glory of God and be transformed into his image, or to sit by the firelight and to be able to read of his life and to see who he was and watch how he acted and watch how he handled people and watch how he dealt with relationships and watch how he talked with his family and watch how he talked with his friends and watch how he dealt with difficult situations and be changed into a different person because I can spend time with Jesus because I have been with him. And maybe that's the thing that gives me the most encouragement, that's the same possibility you and I have today. And that's what we close with today, and simply maybe can give you something to think about. The same Jesus who called these people and who changed their lives and changed the world through their willingness to be obedient and devoted to Him is the same Jesus who has called us to be the same kind of people and has promised us that we can make the same kind of changes in the world through our devotion and our trust in Him. If you need to do that tonight, we can help you. If you need to express your faith and trust in Him, we can teach you, we can encourage you, we can share with you the good news, we can help you to be obedient if that's necessary tonight. Maybe we all can ask ourselves if whether it shows that we are with Jesus, if He really has changed us in the way that He has these people that we've read about. If we can help you tonight, we'd love to do it. Let's stand and sing. Would you let your need be known?